Welcome to the Shaping Portsmouth podcast. Shaping Portsmouth is a collaboration of key Portsmouth businesses, transforming Portsmouth together.
I'm excited to be hosting my first Shaping Portsmouth podcast, a part of a series that will focus on the armed forces. Today's guest is someone whose story moves far beyond uniform because her father wore it, but she lived it too. Sue is a forces child, an advocate, a change maker, and she works with me in the Shaping Portsmouth Armed Forces programme team. She's founder of the Aftershock Project, and she is here to help us see what often goes unseen. It's the emotional legacy of service and the courage it takes to come home, not just physically, but emotionally. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Hi.
Lovely to have you here. Could we just start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. So I was born into a military family. So my dad was a bomb disposal expert in a regiment called EOD 11 or 11 EOD, but it was called 321 EOD back in the 70s. It got changed in the 90s. My mum was in the army. She was only in the army for a few years before she married my dad. She had to leave to marry my dad, so it was in those days where women couldn't stay. But that's a whole nother story. My brother was also in the army. 12 years he did. He is another person that I am immensely proud of what he did. He was a Remy, but he was also a trained para commando, which my understanding is pretty cool. My dad joined the army in the mid-60s, the late-60s. I was born in Hong Kong in 1980. We lived on a little island called Stonecutters Island, which was a munitions depot, which my dad was in charge of. We lived there for a couple of years before we moved back to the UK. But apparently that island, which was in the middle of Hong Kong Harbour, is now either a runway for the new airport or some kind of sewage depot thing. So, yeah, that's not great. But my mum loved it there and my dad loved it there. It was a really happy time for them in Hong Kong. Yeah.
Amazing. Sounds like you had a bit of an adventure growing up.
Yeah, I moved a lot. We moved back to the UK and lived in a place called Didcot. And my dad left the army when I was about 8 or 9. My brother was 11, 12, something like that. It was an interesting time, that period coming back from Hong Kong to when we left. It wasn't an easy time for him. He was, you know, he'd done some incredible things, like in the 70s with all the stuff that was going on with Northern Ireland. He was regularly called out. I think he did either 2 or 3 tours in Northern Ireland as a bomb disposal, and it was at the height of the Troubles. So I think they were being called out about 6 or 7 times a day to different devices or supposed devices. Obviously, they weren't all, but there were many that were. He's been blown up about 3 times.
Blimey.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel a sense of personal connection to the story for 2 reasons. The first one is I'm a forces child myself, as you know. And the second one is I also served 11 EOD regiment. I was at 621 EOD squadron based in RAF Northolt in London. And 321 EOD squadron is still the Northern Ireland squadron. It certainly was last time I knew. And I still, to this day, call them bomb disposal heroes. I won't give you my little dit about who the hero is because, obviously, as a signaller, I can't compete with it getting blown up. If you had one message, Sue, for people listening right now about what it means to grow up as a forces child, what would it be?
it's a unique experience where there was an instability to it. There was a lot of change, but also I think some of my happiest childhood memories are living on barracks where you're free. You know, there used to be about 20 of us just roaming like feral children. I remember like there used to be like a munitions kind of like garages full of stuff, and they used to unwrap all the stuff and leave all of the, you know, that poppy stuff you get which wraps up whatever it is.
We used to get bubble wrap.
That's it.
Poppy stuff.
The stuff you pop. We used to gather it all up and just stick it under the garages and just launch ourselves off the top of the garages. And I was like 3-4 years old. I've got really, really happy memories. And there was no, you know, I know it sounds really cliche, but there was no phones, and there was like 4 channels on the TV, which were really boring during the day. So you're just like, I'm going out. And nobody stopped you. Nobody was worried about you. It was all cordoned off. Yeah. Yeah. And that safety, that sense of community, that's, I think, the hardest part that gets, it doesn't really get spoken about, I don't think, especially for service children, is that all of a sudden that gets taken away when you leave, because it isn't just whoever is serving that leaves. You all leave, and then what? And if the person who was the soldier is struggling, then you all struggle. But you don't know it when you're a kid. You feel it, but it's not something that you fully understand. And sometimes, you know, it can ripple out for the rest of your life unless you're willing to look at that stuff.
So you're 8 years old
when your
dad left the army. Take us back to that moment. When did you realise that your dad's transition out of the military wasn't just his journey, but yours too?
I think I've always kind of known that there was a struggle. You know, my dad's transition was pretty brutal. So you think 22 years, he was a WO1 when he left, so he's as high as he could have got, I suppose. And even in his own words, he's like, he had a lot of control, a lot of kind of status, and which is quite common in kind of services. You know, my mum had left him when I was about 5-6, and she'd met somebody else. And this was coming up to the end of his service. And in his mind, he had thought that, you know, that was a kind of protective factor for him. You leave, you've got a family. He had a job set up in some bomb disposal expert kind of job somewhere. But he then started to kind of spiral just before, and he was a single parent. He started drinking, and I knew even at that young age that he wasn't all right. And so as he left, I don't know whether it was the army that did it or somebody in that kind of in his circle had called this job and said, I wouldn't employ him if I were you, because he's drinking too much. And instead, and this is the thing that really pisses me off, that instead of rallying round him to try and help him, single parent, drinking, they just said, right, there you go, time's done, off you go. And he ended up working for Biffa. And nothing wrong with that kind of work. But when you have, you know, a job lined up, and, you know, of course he probably wasn't in the right state to do it, but if he'd have had the support and help, then he might have been. but he comes out and he starts cleaning out bins. It destroyed him. And there was nothing like there is now. There isn't all the support that there is now. There was literally nothing. And so he didn't have anywhere to live, moved back in with his mum, which also, you know, he must have held so much shame around that kind of thing. But for me, I was still with him. You know, it was, he was my dad, or he is my dad. And no matter what, you love your dad. But when you see somebody that's struggling, even at a young age, you get a sense of that. And you try and do something about it. You know, you try and make them feel better. You want them to be okay. And sometimes responsibilities or burdens, that's not a nice word. There's a different word for it, but I can't think of it. You take on a role to try and make things okay at a very young age. Yeah. So I don't even know if I answered your question. I can't even remember what your question was.
It was really powerful words, Sue. The impact it must have on your dad's pride, his values, his status. You mentioned he was a warrant officer class one EOD, so he'd have been a senior ammunition technician.
Yeah, he was mentioned in dispatches. You know, if anybody, I didn't even know, I kind of found it online. He never even told me. And I asked him not so long ago, I was like, what did you get put forward for? He's like, I have no idea. It could have been a number of things. And I was like, don't you want to know? He's like, no, I don't care. And I'm like, well, I need to know. I want to know. But yeah, we don't know. No idea.
And you've been on a journey of discovery more recently. So you shared a picture of Felix. Felix is the symbol or the logo of 321 EOD Squadron.
Yeah.
And you posted some pictures of your dad in Northern Ireland. Mm. And that must fill you with immense pride.
It's unbelievable. I'd kind of buried it because my, you know, my relationship with my dad, there's so much love there, but there's also, you know, there's a lot of unsaid stuff. And you've got to bury that stuff sometimes. It's not the healthiest of ways to do it, but, you know, I'm a 45-year-old woman. I'm getting on with my life. I'm married. I've got an incredible husband. I've got two children who are thriving. I've got a great job. You know, I've got a beautiful life. So you kind of just start to kind of forget that kind of stuff. And then I don't even know why I applied for the Shaping Forces volunteering role, because I was like, I'd worked in like drug and alcohol treatment services for many, many years. So I'd always done work that was of service. It was always part of my value set of who I was. And I burnt out about 3 years ago. There's a shelf life for that kind of work. So I did a different job, much less stressful. And then I kind of saw the Shaping Forces volunteering thing, and there was something in me that kind of stirred, like, oh, that would be a really kind of lovely role. You'll be of service. Didn't really know too much about what it was about. I just kind of like wrote something, sent it in, had me interview, got it. And then I started kind of spending, not that much time, but spending time with you all. And talking a bit about my dad and talking a bit about being a military child. And then something just unlocked in me.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I'd forgotten. And it wasn't the memories that I'd forgotten. I'd forgotten what it felt like to remember how proud I am.
It's a really positive thing, being proud.
Yeah, it feels good. And I'd forgotten, like, how in awe I am of my dad and my brother particularly. You know, the stuff that they've done. and the way they carry themselves. You know, there's such a dignity to it, and there's a humility, and they don't brag about it. They don't. And I'm like, I want to shout from the rooftops again. I want you to know. People should know what my dad did. But I know that's just one story in amongst many, many families who have this conflicted, God, there's some shit going on. But also, I am in awe of you. I am immensely proud of you. But also, I can see how what you did and what you went through has impacted you. And it's trying to find the balance between acknowledging that, but also acknowledging that this stuff ripples through families as well, the impact of that kind of service.
I wonder what his manager at Biffa would have thought if he knew that he was a bomb disposal expert who's mentioned in dispatches and got blown up in Northern Ireland.
You know what? He wouldn't have told him.
He wouldn't have told him.
He wouldn't have told him. He doesn't hardly tell anybody. I bet he's got a whole circle of friends. He goes and plays bowls now. You know, he's like really old. He plays bowls in his, you know, they've probably all got their white kits on and none of them know. Oh. I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm his daughter. I think there's an injustice in that. You know, this stuff that people have done. You know, because with bomb disposal, especially in Northern Ireland, they were there to save lives. They weren't taking anybody's life. And they were putting their life on the line to save people's lives. And many of them did. Many of them died.
There's an amazing picture of an operator in Northern Ireland in the 70s or 80s. It's called The Long Walk. I think I sent you it.
Yeah.
And it's a guy walking down doing a manual approach to an IED, and he's carrying something, I think it's some form of weapon to blow the device up. And on the wall right in front of him, there's a huge sign that says, "May God have mercy on thy soul."
God, yeah.
I mean, what a powerful image. Yeah. That could well have been your dad.
When you sent it to me, I sent it to my brother, and then he sent me a couple of pictures which I'd never seen before. It's like, how do I not know this stuff? That's just in and of itself quite telling, that, you know, how do I not, why have I never been told this stuff? My brother knows, but that's because he's army as well, and he probably prodded my dad and prodded. I've got a few pictures of my dad in all the gear next to some kind of beer barrel. Yeah,
I love how proud of him you are, and how the whole time you're talking about him, you've got a big smile on your face.
Yeah.
And that pride really shines through. I read your first blog.
Mm.
I really enjoyed it. So thank you for sharing it with everybody. And you talk about, you talk about quite a few things in there. But one of the things you mention is that the military trains people for war, not for home. Does coming home mean to you now?
So I can only kind of compare how my husband is. So he's a firefighter, so he's kind of somewhere in between. Hmm. And
there's a lot of similarities, you know, between firefighters and soldiers.
I know, I know. Yeah. I would never have married a soldier.
They're like soldiers, but with union.
Yeah. Yeah. And he is the most steady, grounded, stable, funniest man you will ever meet. But he's home. He's with us. He's present. He's engaged with the boys. He is constantly doing stuff with them. And he doesn't prioritize other things over us. We are his absolute number one. And that's helped me to understand what it's like to be in a family which is settled. You know, we've stayed in the same house for 15 years. The boys were born in the QA. You know, he works in Southsea. I work in Portsmouth. We're not going anywhere.
You're not moving house.
I am. No, I'm going to die in that house. Like I've written, I am going nowhere. I have moved. I've lived in three different countries. I've been to nine different schools. I've moved untold amount of times, houses, like in the tens of houses. And it's difficult and it's unsettling and it takes a long time to build community, and particularly when you're older. And I wouldn't want my children, I want them to have roots, and they've got that.
What impact does that have, Sue? Because it's really hard for me to get my head around it, because as a forces child myself, and then as a serving soldier, I've never been static.
Mm-hmm.
But what impact do you believe it has on the forces family, not having that stability and not having those roots?
Well, we left the military when I was nine. I hadn't moved that much. I carried on. I didn't stop.
I still haven't stopped.
Right. I stopped when I met my husband. I was going to go travelling just before I met him. I was nearly 30. You know, I kept moving every couple of years. Right, this is going to be where I'm going to find my happiness. This is where it's really going to land for me. And then a couple of years later, I'd be like, I get itchy feet. I'm going to go again. And what I noticed was it wasn't the place. What made home home was the people that I loved and where they were and being with them. And I created my home with my family, and so there's no need to move because I'm with them.
Can we unpick that as a challenge then? So what you've described there is you just moved every 2 years, and I think I'm still in that state, although I've been sort of around this area now for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not by design, by chance. What does it mean? Why is it important?
You know, it's stuff like when you walk out the door and somebody drives past who lives down the road and they wave at you. You're like, oh, yeah.
Big Steve.
Yeah. I don't know how I know him, but I've kind of come across him and met him, and, you know, my husband knows him. And then there's like the kids' football. I've met a group of women that I would never, ever have made a choice to hang out with if it wasn't for the kids' football. But we've formed over the years, because we've had to consistently be in each other's company, we've formed these friendships which are lovely. You know, I look forward to going sitting with them once a week for an hour. And then other kind of groups of friends which I've built bonds with through all of the kind of different practices that I do to try and kind of make sure that I'm okay and my mental health and my physical health is okay. I've got friends who are like-minded in that way. And it takes time to walk in a room, sit down with somebody and just feel at ease with them without having to make bullshit conversation and all that small talk. It takes time, and it takes more than 2 years to do that. It takes years and years of consistency and going and doing stuff that you might be like, this is really uncomfortable. Like this. This is the first podcast I've ever done.
You're doing great.
Oh, thanks. But it's like this, I was really nervous. And even, you know, the thought of kind of this going out and people listening to it. But then it's like, okay, so why is it important to me to do this? You know, what matters about this? And it's actually, you know, I spent so many years holding space for other people to tell their stories. I never actually got out and told my story. And I want to be able to tell my story with the hope that it will support others who might not be able to talk about it or think that they're the only ones who've kind of struggled with that stuff. Because, you know, in army circles, there's a tendency not to talk about this kind of stuff. And I find it quite interesting that families particularly don't, what I've come across or what I've researched is that families, and this may be out of, you know, respect or fear of judgment, but they don't talk enough about how did service impact us or how is it impacting us.
It's really interesting. I think probably 10 years ago there was very little in the way of resettlement for service leavers. I think there was the standard stuff that is provided, but I think the amount of organisations that have sprung up now to support that make it, notwithstanding the job market currently, but make it quite relatively straightforward.
Mm.
There's lots of information available for those that don't bury their head in the sand. I've also noticed that there are organisations springing up that support the force's spouse mm-hmm. as well.
Mm.
But until I met you, I'd never considered the wider forces family, despite having one myself, that the impact may, as in your words, ripple through the whole family. Mm. I've got three children and they spent, right up until 2019, their whole lives as part of a forces family.
Mm.
So it's a really interesting concept and something I think that we may be breaking new ground with in our team. So this feels to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, almost like a healing journey.
Yeah, yeah.
Discovery and healing.
Yeah, I'd spent 20 years doing all sorts of kind of, it's a real cliche word. It's a crappy word as well, I think. But, you know, I'd kind of spent years doing, I was a mindfulness teacher. I went off and I did all sorts of kind of nervous system, educational, trauma-informed work, knowing that, you know, I'd been through some shit and I needed to kind of, you know, find a better way because I'd found coping mechanisms in my late teens and early 20s, which were unworkable. There is no way that I could have carried on that way. You know, you talk about generational trauma that gets passed down. It gets passed down and you find ways, until you understand what's going on for you, you find ways to soothe your system because it can become unbearable. And there are many ways of doing it and some are much more dysfunctional than others. And I went down, you know, I rebelled in epic style. And my dad, you know, he became a rescuer. He came when it was a crisis and he'd come and rescue me. But then I'd go back to what I was doing and it got to a point where I was like, nobody's going to rescue me. I've got to do it myself. I've got to rescue myself. And so I had to find ways and means of doing that. And the thing that was most transformational for me was education. I got myself educated. I went and studied at a really good university. It's called social anthropology. It looks at us as humans in social settings. Because I'd moved so much, it kind of made sense. Mm-hmm. I'd morphed and I'd become different things and I had to adapt really quickly. And this kind of topic really helped me to understand myself. And then I started working in therapeutic settings. So by osmosis, you start to, you know, absorb the stuff that you learn. But I had never tapped into how being a military child had shaped me until I started working with you guys. So, and it feels like I've spent my whole life leading up to this.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It sounds really kind of...
That's big.
It does sound big. And one of my friends said to me the other day, she's like, this sounds like this is your heart's mission.
Wow. You stopped me in my tracks a little bit there. Okay. So with that in mind, what do you bring to the Shaping Portsmouth Armed Forces team? As well as all of that, of course.
Well, you know, I'm kind of co-lead on the well-being support signposting pillar part of it. Is it a pillar?
It's a catchy title.
Yeah, we need to find a better one. But, you know, because I've spent so long working in frontline services, I've lived in Portsmouth now for like 20 years. I kind of know the landscape quite well. And for those that are in need of some kind of support, then, you know, the probability is that I will know where to kind of signpost them. But also, and I really like the little video that you put out about us, and I think you called me the... Is it the navigator? Is it or something to do with a compass? Like, kind of what are we doing this for? And it's just to kind of raise awareness around how impactful it can be to be in a family of a veteran, and just to keep that on the radar, you know, think about the wider context as well of the family that might be impacted.
Yeah, so leading on that sort of signposting and support pillar alongside the brilliant Tom, I believe that you'd make a really good team because Tom's got the lived experience of being a veteran.
Mm.
And you've got the lived experience of being part of a forces family, and you've seen both between you. You've seen both sides. Of course, he's got his own family, so he sees that too. And I think it's my focus when I first started with Shaping Portsmouth was much more about the service leaver and the veteran, and I hadn't really considered the family, which is really selfish.
Mm.
But having now spent time with you and with Charlie, and the wider team. I think there's so little focus on the family that we need to change that.
Mm.
We need to make sure that there is signposting in place for families, whether that's the spouse, whether that's the male or female, whether that's the family, the children, grown up or young.
Yeah.
It's all about making sure that we know what is available in terms of help, support, signposting, education, all of those things.
Yeah.
Thank you. So you are, as I mentioned at the beginning, the founder of the brilliantly named Aftershock Project.
Mm.
Now,
yeah.
I know it's brand new.
And
I know you haven't really fully formulated what you're doing with it, but can you just describe to us what it is and what is the vision or the purpose behind it?
So what I've started doing as a way of kind of making sense of what I'm experiencing and all the kind of pride and the awe and the confusion and anger and all of that kind of stuff, I've started writing. So I would just kind of like spill out all my thoughts and then I'd read them back and I was like, God, this is really quite powerful stuff, and I wanted to find a way of a platform to share it, and it made sense to kind of, you know, the aftershock. My dad was a bomb disposal, you know there is literally kind of like, you know, bombs going off in households that people are too focused on kind of what's going on with that. They're not really thinking about how does that kind of ripple out, or what is the aftershock? And all I can do, I'm not an expert in anybody else's experience, but what I can do is I can speak to my own experience and how that's affected me, how it's impacted me, but also the stuff that I've done to create a life which has got purpose and meaning and love. And I think I want to share that somehow. But it's still early days. You know, I've only been doing it for like a couple of months. But yeah, I guess the vision at the moment would be to keep doing this, keep shaping, sharing my story, finding a way for it to be most impactful and supportive to people. But stories start to kind of, it's a practice, isn't it? Telling your story for it to be most impactful. So I guess I would like the aftershock to be a way for me to practice telling my story in the most meaningful and impactful way.
Wow. Storytelling is so powerful anyway.
I didn't realise. So
powerful. So how could listeners read your blogs on the workshop?
It's on something called Substack, which is like a fairly new platform, which is, I think my Substack thing is at the Aftershock Project. So you download the app. You don't have to download the app. You can just search for it on Google.
Or a desktop, yeah.
Yeah, and then I've only got three on there at the moment. There's one about, you know, my experience from a daughter's perspective. Then there's one a bit more detail about my dad's regiment and what they did. And then there's another one about my experience on how I've kind of come to feel a sense of belonging in Portsmouth. Because I hated it here. 20 years ago, I hated it here. I was like, this place. And then, you know, now I love it. I love it. You know, I'm here. This is my home.
I'm still in the shock of capture phase. So at the Aftershock Project, that's where they can read your blogs if they wish to. I've read the first two. I've got to say, it's really, really powerful. Really interesting, and it was why I was in a bit of a scramble to get you on to a podcast quite quickly. We've skirted around the edges of it a little bit, but what kinds of support do you believe that families of veterans need that still isn't being talked about enough?
Somebody said that when I don't know where I read it or heard it or listened to it, that when you go out on a tour, you get like a half an hour talk about kind of, you know, the impact of trauma. And I was just like, what do they tell people before they're going out? I don't even know what they tell them. But I think like some kind of psychological, educational, not therapy, you know, that really puts people off that word. It's not all that kind of stuff. It's nervous system understanding. So understanding what's happening in your nervous system, in your body, because a lot of people think that it's all to do with the mind. It's all to do with thinking and trying to think your way out of stuff, trying to think your way to be better, to feel better. Whereas the body that's not the language that the body uses. It uses a different language, and most of us are quite disconnected from what our bodies are telling us, and our emotions are felt within our bodies. And I think if there was much more training and educational stuff in the army, like before you even leave, like way, way, way before, like how to soothe your nervous system to understand what's going on, I think that is what's missing, that kind of psycho-educational stuff around. It doesn't have to be related to PTSD. We've all got a nervous system that gets activated, and there are so many techniques to kind of soothe it. And mindfulness is one of them, which is, you know, kind of been hijacked in certain kind of areas. But there are loads of other ways that you can settle your nervous system But you've got to understand and be aware that you're in an activated state, because we can just keep fueling that difficult state, anxiety and stress. And
where can people learn more about that? If there are people like you that are listening that are experiencing, you know, the aftershock of service or whatever it might be, families, where can they access information?
There's loads of resources out there. There's one really good book which I really recommend highly to anybody that I come across. It's fairly accessible. It's not too academic. It's called The Body Keeps the Score by I can't remember his name. Is that Van somebody or other? But it's
Van Damme?
Van
Vin Diesel.
No. I'll have a look. But he talks a lot about if you go through something traumatic, like how the body can hold on to it. And he articulates it so well. He speaks about it so well. Google that. The Body Keeps the Score.
The Body Keeps the Score. And of course, if anybody wants to know more about this type of stuff, just get on the Shaping Portsmouth website and drop an email. It'll find its way to Sue, and I'm sure you'd be happy to.
Oh yeah, I can send loads of links. Yeah, lots of practices, lots of ways of supporting your body to feel a bit calmer.
Thank you. I'm going to bring you back to your dad. If your dad heard this conversation, what would you want him to know or hear you say out loud?
Gonna get me going again. That through my understanding of my own stuff, I get why he is the way he is, and I get why things unfolded the way they did, and it's not anyone's fault, and that I love him.
I'm sure he knows that soon.
Yeah, he does.
And just a final question for you, thank you. For someone who's listening, who's a veteran or a Forces family member, quietly struggling, what would you want them to take from this conversation?
I hear so many people say that I'm broken. Not me, they. They think they're broken. Like beyond repair. And I don't believe that's true. I don't believe anybody is broken. I just think that people get stuck. And it takes a hell of a lot of courage to reach out and ask somebody for help. And what I would say is that the system does need some work. You know, I called one of these organisations, I won't name the organisation, but it just rang and rang and rang and rang. And I thought, if that was anybody who was doing that for the first time.
In crisis,
they would never, ever reach out again. And I thought, that's not on. That is not okay. But what I would say is that there are some organisations out there and the system is a bit disorganised. But keep going, because you will find somebody that you will resonate with, that you will find a connection with. Don't give up at the first hurdle, because you'll come across people and you'll think, I can't talk to them. I can't relate to them. I am not going to tell them anything about myself. But you will find somebody, and you're not beyond having a life which you find meaning and purpose. It just takes work and time.
And of course, our role as the Armed Forces programme team for Shaping Portsmouth is to make Portsmouth the best place in the United Kingdom to be a member of the Armed Forces community. And we couldn't do that without your experience, Sue, because nobody has got that lived experience that you've got. So if anybody's listening that this is really resonating with it and they're feeling a connection to Sue's story, please, please reach out. Sue and Tom are leading the pillar on the signposting and support services. They've got lots of information, not lots of knowledge between them, and I'm sure they'd love to hear from you. Any final thoughts, Sue, before we...
Yeah, wouldn't it be great, you know, that statistic you said around like quarter of the people who live in Portsmouth are either ex-military or ex-services or family, yeah. And it's like, you know, there's an opportunity to make this city somewhere where people are like, I'm going to go there and I know that I belong. And yeah, it takes time, but there'll be stuff where they can try and test things. And, you know, meet people that they feel a connection with.
Amazing. So thanks for your time today. Looking forward to your reading your third blog and seeing where you go with the Aftershock Project. Again, brilliant name. Absolutely love it. I think that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Shaping Portsmouth, working to make Portsmouth the number one UK city in which to invest, live, learn, work and visit. To find out more, please visit shapingportsmouth.co.uk. This podcast was supported by Spark Community Space and Portsmouth Community Lottery.